The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in these articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. You may remember that in our previous episode of Armchair Traveler that we had a story about how climate change is affecting one of the few remaining ski areas in Rhode Island. Now, our first story on today's Armchair Traveler follows that theme. It's headlined, "The Latest Victim of a Snowless West, Dog Sledding." This is written by Gabe Castro Root, and it appeared in the February 9th, 2026 issue of the New York Times, and it's quite interesting. And we have a subhead here that shows a team of sled dogs, black, tan, and white, pulling a racing sled across a snowy expanse. And it's part of the Warm Lake Stage Race. This is a 52-mile event, and it's part of the Idaho Dog Sled Challenge that has not been canceled the last 3 years. Now the story. A massive snow drought across the western United States this winter is threatening water supplies and resulting in one of the worst ski seasons in decades. On Monday, which would have been February 9th, the drought claimed its latest victim, the Idaho Sled Dog Challenge, one of just a few lower 48 qualifiers for the famed Iditarod Sled Dog Race in Alaska. It will shut down permanently after 3 consecutive years of cancellations caused by low snow or avalanche risk. Now, again, that's the Idaho Sled Dog Challenge closing down, not the Iditarod. Organizers of the Idaho race had announced on January 1st that the 2026 competition was canceled due to dismal snow levels and unsafe trail conditions. The multi-day contest, hosted annually about 75 miles north of Boise, was part of the Rocky Mountain Triple Crown, along with races in Oregon and Montana, which were canceled this winter. Organizers of Race to the Sky, the Montana competition, cited bare ground, icy and rock-hard sections, unseasonably warm temperatures, and no measurable snow in the forecast as the reasons for their cancellation. "It's heartbreaking to the organizers and the volunteers in the mushing community," said Tony Harrison, a spokesman for the Idaho race, referring to dog sled drivers who are called mushers. Now, the Idaho Challenge included a 300-mile race with 36,000 feet of total elevation gain and a 100-mile race, both of which were canceled this year, as well as a 52-mile event that took place in late January. Rick Kentucky, a 72, a race marshal for the Idaho Challenge, who has been involved in dog sledding for 3 decades, called the contest in a big disappointment, but added he wasn't surprised. "The problems began long ago before this year's snow drought. In 2024, the long-distance races were called off because there was not enough snow. Wildfire damaged forced modifications to last year's route," Mr. Kentucky said, "and intense snow and rainfall ahead of the competition caused concerns about a possible avalanche that resulted in the 100-mile event being canceled mid-race. Research has found that weather whiplash, in which weather patterns boomerang between extreme precipitation one year and extreme drought the next, is becoming a hallmark sign of climate change across the West." Mr. Kentucky said all that unpredictability made it difficult to attract and retain sponsors. "Even the Iditarod, which covers roughly 1,000 miles of Alaskan wilderness each March, has not been immune. Organizers shortened last year's ceremonial start in downtown Anchorage because of a lack of snow and adjusted another segment after an absence of snowfall made part of the course impassable. We just don't have the predictable snow base that we used to out here in the West," Mr. Harrison said. And by the way, the author, Gabe Castro Root, is a travel reporter, and he's a member of the 2025-26 New York Times Fellowship Class. This is a program for journalists early in their careers. So there you have why there's no dog sledding in Idaho this year. Interesting story, to say the least. Well, our next story was published last weekend, not established. And that's when we celebrated Valentine's, as you may recall. Now, the headline explains what this story is about. It says, "The most romantic place this Valentine's Day is not where you'd expect." Now, this is Andrea Sachs' story and was published in the Valentine's Day edition of the New York Times. Miss Sachs, we've had many of her stories on Armchair Travelers. She's a veteran writer. She goes on to write, "This Valentine's Day, Ben Smith and Kelly Dennis will profess their love for each other in New York City in front of loved ones, strangers, and possibly Batman." So, with that sentence spoken, let me just get your imagination going here. Think back to Valentine's and these people who want to profess their love for each other in New York City. Ready? Now we continue. "The Philadelphia area lovebirds will be one of two couples to marry in Times Square, the high-voltage tourist attraction that transforms into a destination wedding venue every February 14th. After the nuptials, hundreds of dyads will renew their vows as part of Love in Times Square." Now, this is a long-running tradition held by the Times Square Alliance. That's a neighborhood nonprofit. "The day-long event, which also includes two surprise proposals, celebrates several major milestones in the affairs of the heart. We cover every stage of relationships," said Joe Papa, the Alliance's senior director of events and programming. "You can have a first date at a Broadway show or one of our restaurants. You can pop the question here. You can get married here. Or, if you're already married, you can renew your wedding vows." This year, the organization received a record number of submissions for the weddings, 56 to be precise, and proposals, there were 40, with couples applying from a dozen states and eight countries. This included the United States for four of the four slots. Now, for the selection process, which involves an online application, photos, and a follow-up phone call, Papa said the committee considers a variety of factors such as genuine enthusiasm for the idea and a personal connection to or appreciation of the legendary neighborhood. Now, among this holiday's strong contenders was an Australian couple who have never visited New York, but Papa said, "Know that the heart of New York City is here in Times Square." The 10 to 15 minute vow renewal ceremony is open to everyone, assuming they can all fit on the red steps atop the TKTS booth, which Papa said can accommodate roughly 500 people. Now, participants seal their commitment, or recommitment, I should say, with a kiss and a blinking heart-shaped ring. It's a party favor from the Alliance. When you're on the red steps with 200 other couples renewing their wedding vows, it has a communal effect that feels larger than any one person, Papa said. The Alliance covers the cost of the site and an officiant, and sponsors such as David's Bridal and neighborhood businesses will throw in gifts and special deals. The chosen pairs must pay for their own travel and accommodations and obtain a New York State marriage license, which officiant Hollis Cam will sign and submit for an official marriage certificate. Smith and Dennis filled out the paperwork in their home state and were legally married in December. There is no dressing room or bridal suite, just a warming tent. "This is not by any means a cookie-cutter wedding ceremony. It's a unique setting," Papa said. "We make it very clear that this is the middle of Times Square, one of the busiest public spots in the world." Last year, according to the Alliance, upward of 240,200 pedestrians traipsed through Times Square per day. Now, with all that in mind, we go to 7 weddings in a day for the next section. During the early years of the program, Cam said he would marry 5 to 7 people in often chilly or snowy conditions. He shivers at the memory of Valentine's Day 2015, when temperatures were so frigid the organization set up a temporary shelter for participants. In 2017, the Alliance tinkered with its love potion formula, reducing the number of weddings to 2, plus the pair of proposals and vow renewals, both introduced 13 years ago. Cam, a senior vice president at the organization, said the experience is more intimate and personalized with fewer weddings. "About 2 weeks before the wedding, we will talk to them about what the ceremony will look like and go over the script because of the timing," said Cam, who became an officiant in 2008 through an online certification program. "We have about a 7-minute ceremony, but we want to make it special, so we ask if there's anything they want to change or swap out." One bride, a Broadway fan, carried a bouquet of playbills of her favorite shows. Cam said couples have incorporated biblical scripture, poems, or have their children at the vows. Now, some aspects are non-negotiable, such as the start times and locations. Knots are always tied in Duffy Square, with an original love theme artwork framing the couple. This year's installation, Making Love, features several classic New York City vignettes, such as a bodega and the Gowanus Canal. The proposals occur under the Everest Digital, formerly American Eagle sign, which will project their big ask on a 6,200-square-foot screen. After a few minutes, there will be, "Will you disappear?" That question mark there. Now, hopefully they're on time and they pop the question and the partner says yes, in which case there's confetti, Papa said. Now, sometimes a surprise guest will crash the festivities. 3 years ago, fashion designer Christian Siriano married one of the couples. At the vow renewal ceremony, cast members from a Broadway musical perform a song. Couples have been serenaded by actors from Moulin Rouge, Phantom of the Opera, The Notebook, and this year's selection, Two Strangers Carry a Cake Across New York. A lot of folks come back year after year to be part of this, Papa said. Now, the next section is headlined A Wedding and Annual Vow Renewals. On Saturday, and this was February 14th, Dennis and Smith, high school sweethearts who often rode the train into Penn Station for dates in the city, will be up first, the 11 a.m. slot. Dennis, age 24, will wear a traditional white gown from David's Bridal, a gift. She is favoring long sleeves to ward off the winter chill. Smith, age 25, will don a free rental tux, another perk of the Love and Time Square wedding package. Some of our happiest memories were in New York, said Dennis, a certified medical assistant. It was my dream to have our wedding there. When PJ Kim and Jang Choi became engaged in 2013, they knew they wanted to marry in New York City, her hometown, his adopted city, and the setting of their love story. They didn't have to search far or long to find a site close to their hearts. The powers that accepted their application to wed by the Great White Way. Times Square is one of the places in New York City where you find everyone, from locals like us to people from around the world, coming together in this one space, said Choi, a non-practicing lawyer. Even though New York is a huge city, Times Square feels so intimate, she said. For the 2014 wedding, several friends who work near Times Square promised to drop by during their lunch break. As party favors, the couple ordered a giant arrangement of red balloons, which they handed out to guests who attended by invitation or by happenstance. Afterward, they walked to the W Hotel Bar for their reception. Whenever any of our friends are getting married, we're like, get married in Times Square, Choi said. Every year on their anniversary, the Kims renew their vows in Times Square, accompanied by their three daughters, and that includes the youngest. Her name, Valentine. Quite appropriate, don't you think? Yes, an interesting and great story there. Well, writer Andrea Sachs is going to do double duty today. We just heard about the Times Square affair. Now, she's also written our next story. Amtrak's new trains are arriving soon. Now, here's what to expect. The article appeared in the February 11, 2026 issue of the New York Times. The editor's note, upgrades to the trains mean no more fighting for power with your neighbor or touching icky bathroom handles. In August, the company launched the next-gen Acela, an upgrade of the high-speed train that, when it's launched in December 2000, offered travelers a racehorse alternative to the workhorses along the Northeast Corridor. So all that is talking about the new trains going into effect here for Amtrak. Now, this summer, if all goes well, Amtrak is going to roll out the first clutch of trains in its shiny new Aero fleet, an $8 billion project that the company hopes will usher in a more modern, comfortable, and accessible age of rail travel, and it's a big order in many ways. For the Aero fleet, the company ordered 73 trains from Siemens in June 2021 and later added 10 more. 8 6-car trains will serve the Cascades route, which runs from Vancouver, British Columbia, to Eugene, Oregon. Next in line is the Northeast Corridor. Now, the remainder of trains will hit the tracks from North Carolina to Maine, including routes in New York State and Pennsylvania. Amtrak President Roger Harris said at a February 10th event, which was a preview at Union Station in Washington, D.C. Now, the company said it plans to integrate Aero into the Northeast Regional Service in 2027. Now, Amtrak executives said the project is on budget and on schedule. The timing of Aero is opportune. Amtrak said ridership has been steadily climbing over the last 3 years. A record 34.5 million travelers logged trips last year. That's a 5.1% increase over 2024. The Aero fleet will set a higher standard for regional and intercity travel, replacing trains that are up to 50 years old, Harris said. Our North Star for this whole project can be summarized in two words, the customer. If the customer experience truly was the company's guiding light, did Amtrak succeed? During a sneak peek of the train, we reclined seats, unfolded tray tables, and nearly performed cartwheels in the bathroom to determine whether Aero is really built for us. Next section is headline green is the new silver. With its forest green and bark brown exterior, Aero evokes the woodsy landscape and outdoorsy lifestyle of the Pacific Northwest. The image of a snowy mountain is open for interpretation. Is it Mount Hood, Mount Rainier, or Grouse Mountain, or all of the above? Though the interior isn't plaid flannel, the color palette is soothing with a touch of haiga. Now, the seats are the light gray of a brightening overcast sky. A pop of green peeks out from behind the headrest like a Douglas fir tree treetop rising between buildings. Now, the tables and trays resemble the blonde wood hue popularized by Scandinavian designers. The aesthetic is unique to the Cascades, however. Amtrak executives said the trains on the East Coast will stick to the standard tricolor of red, white, and blue. Now, as we move along, we wanted to take a look at some of these other things. They have a lot of touches that shine. A tray table components intuit a traveler's ever-changing wants and needs. You can pull out the small shelf and watch a movie on your gadget, accompanied by a beverage store between sips and a separate cup holder. For a meal and a movie, you can employ the full tray plus the ledge with a latch that holds a tablet in place. A personal light attached to the seat keeps the cone of illumination on you and not slumbering passengers. Best of all, each seat has its own outlet in the middle console, so no more bugging your window seat neighbor for some juice. Being on the receiving end of a reclining passenger can quickly lower your quality of travel. Problem solved, the seats slide forward, not back, so you don't infringe on anyone's personal space except your own. Accessible corridors and seat configurations. The Aero pushes accessibility to the forefront, from sweeping design changes to the smallest details such as adjustable tables and braille seat numbers. All of our new trains are highly accessible, and we're spending $2 billion on making stations more accessible, Harris said. It's really a core theme for Amtrak. Starting with the boarding process, coach cars are equipped with integrated wheelchair lifts, which are essential for navigating low-level platforms. Once on board, travelers with mobility issues can move more fluidly through the accessible corridors, which at 32 inches are wider than standard passenger ways. The entryways and bathrooms offer a 60-inch radius of turning space, and that's ample enough to rotate a wheelchair, according to Amtrak. Now, the new seat configurations cater to individuals who use mobility devices. For instance, by the bathrooms, a window seat paired with an open aisle seat can accommodate a passenger traveling with a wheelchair and a companion. It also provides extra room if they wish to transfer to the seat. Two large buttons, one to call for assistance, another for the light, are within easy reach. One seating arrangement can accommodate two people in the wheelchairs with a table between them for a picnic purchased in the cafe, a cafe car, I should say, or delivered by a food cart. A bathroom you'll want to use. Normally, I'd rather abstain from beverages for the entire train trip than use an onboard outhouse, restroom. That's the author's words. The Arrow's facilities, by comparison, as she writes, are pure luxury. First, you could hold a dance party inside the spacious laboratory. All of the features are touchless, so you will no longer have to flush the toilet with your foot or close the door with your elbow. Set against an entire wall, the baby changing table allows parents to switch out diapers without having to torque their bodies. In a touch of civility, a little shelf holds small bags and comes with three hooks for coats or other hanging accessories. There are several hand grips in case the train jostles while you are taking care of business. In case of emergency, you can press the call button. Dining in your seat. Now, the Safe Cafe car is strictly for ordering. With no tables, the message is to grab your goodies and go back to your seat. Amtrak said the menu, still a work in progress, will incorporate regional flavors and brands. I didn't see any salmon or Stumptown coffee in the sample cantina, but I did notice Tim's Cascade-style potato chips, Bob's Red Mill oatmeal, and Alki Bakery cinnamon rolls, and grilled chicken Caesar salad. A service card is also in development, though Amtrak could not say whether passengers will be able to order the items on an app or during the cart's rounds. One of the nicest additions on the railway's food and beverage scene are the filtered water dispensers, a staple in airports. The refillable bottle service, which pairs well with the renovated restrooms, is an amenity I would use without hesitation. So, the new Amtrak, if you will, described in detail there. Very interesting. Well, this headline is going to reveal where our next story is headed. Window shade up or down on a plane? You'll make enemies either way. As writer Hannah Sampson discovered, some people love a dark tube. Some want to watch the world go by. And her article appeared in the February 12th, 2026 issue of the Washington Post. And she begins her story, Jeffrey Morgenthaler was flying home from Grand Cayman last month when he noticed something distressing. The view was gorgeous, but he was the only one enjoying it. Every other window closed, the Portland, Oregon bartender and author said. He took his observation to social media. Can we renormalize leaving the windows open on daytime flights? He asked in a post on Threads. I'm flying over the beautiful Caribbean in a dark metal tube right now. The reactions poured in. Many were pro-darkness. Some were hostile. Someone asked what Morgenthaler thought he would see from 35,000 feet above. Well, am I crazy? The 54-year-old said in an interview. I just think it's very beautiful. It's the miracle of flight, and it's stunning out there. It's planet Earth. With this question, Morgenthaler unknowingly waded into a debate that has been raging in public discourse for years. Why window shade should be kept closed on your next flight, reads a headline on a travel blog view from the wing. The Wall Street Journal chronicled showdown on the window seat in 2019. A take from Slate, flying is better with an open window shade. Guides to window shade rules abound. Well, on social media, feelings run hot. Tales fly about people reaching across passengers to lower their shades, but keeping them closed is a borderline sociopathic trend, according to some. Others say having the window open while people try to sleep is diabolical. Even the president of the United States has weighed in, kind of. According to media reports, President Donald Trump recently said at the National Prayer Breakfast that he doesn't sleep on planes and prefers looking out the window, watching for missiles and enemies, actually. Maricel Salazar, a cookbook author and food and travel writer, posted a picture on Threads of a bright window and part of an arm in the row in front of her on a December flight. She said the glare was bothering her and others around the man, but she didn't ask him to lower his shade. It wasn't sure if etiquette would even allow for that. She put on sunglasses to ward off a headache and kept her own shade closed. It's pretty annoying to be wide awake and not be able to do anything else on an airplane because somebody else is causing a disturbance, Salazar told the Washington Post. She called the reaction to her post viral and divisive, skewed toward the crowd who believed that whoever paid for the ticket had the control and eventually turned the comments off. People are extremely passionate about it, she said. I think it's like the new reclining seat. Window etiquette. Etiquette expert Jacqueline Whitmore, a former flight attendant, said there are no strict rules about the position of a window shade, just personal preference and common sense. But it's clear who gets to make the call, she said. The person sitting in the window seat has the responsibility or privilege of controlling the shade. If neighboring passengers in the middle or aisle seats are suffering from the glare, she said, it's fine to politely ask the person by the window if they could lower their shade. If they can tell there's an issue with the light, most people will accommodate the request, she said. One irritating habit travelers should avoid, constantly opening and closing the window. That's something you really shouldn't do, Whitmore said. It's okay to ask if someone is willing to open their window, too, as long as they're not sleeping. Maybe the pilot just announced you'll be passing over something picturesque and you'd like to try a sneak peek. No guarantees, though. If you feel like you're missing out, I would just say book a window seat, Whitmore said. Rich Henderson, a Philadelphia-based flight attendant for a major U.S. airline and a host of the podcast Two Guys on a Plane, said passengers sometimes ask flight attendants if they can intervene to get shades lowered, but he prefers the customers try to work it out between themselves. You try first, and I'll come back as a backup as needed, he said. Henderson said he's witnessed the debate between some people who want darkness and some people who don't for nearly 13 years that he's been in the profession. Both sides of the spectrum are so diehard about it, he said. Those favoring the dark often want to see the screen of their electronics better or sleep to readjust to a time zone, even in broad daylight. Fans of open windows praise the views, but also say the position helps them deal with claustrophobia, anxiety, or motion sickness. Henderson likes the windows on the Boeing 787 Dreamliner, which can be electronically dimmed to varying degrees rather than just open or shut. Just dim it a little, you can still look out the window, and you're really not bothering anyone, he said. Henderson said that when he flies as a passenger, he's glued to the window at takeoff and landing to observe the conditions and make sure there's nothing that would need immediate attention. At cruise, the window is shut, he said. Best practice. The Federal Aviation Administration does not require window shade position, though individual airlines might make requests. United, for example, said in a statement that it encourages customers to open their shades before takeoff and landing, but does not have a requirement in place. Now, Delta may ask passengers in exit rows to keep their shades up for safety visibility, the airline said in a statement. Flight attendants are safety professionals and may request a window shade to be open or closed during specific events and ask that customers comply with these requests, the carrier said. Delta noted that most airlines in Europe and Asia require window shades to be open when the plane takes off and lands. This so crew members can see conditions outside and so people's eyes can adjust to the outside light in case of an emergency. The International Air Transport Association, a global trade group, said it's best practice to have open shades during the taxi, takeoff, and landing portion of flights. That position allows all cabin occupants, including the cabin crew, to improve situational awareness and be aware of any external emergency situation which may require evacuation. A new thing? Well, Morgenthaler said he's noticed a greater shift toward in-flight darkness in the past few years, as well as flight attendants asking passengers to close their windows as they leave to keep the plane cool. He's noticed a trend particularly on U.S. flights. This just seems like a new thing where everybody seems to want to sit in the dark and play on their phones, he said. He's been asked many times to close his window and abides by generally accepted norms of air travel. If the sun's blazing in and making everything hot, pull the shade down, he said. I understand what the rules of etiquette are. I am not a monster. Now, Kelly Ming, 27, cooking and lifestyle content creator, was on a January flight from Chicago to Tokyo that stayed sunny as it headed over the Arctic. She recounted in a video on TikTok how exactly one person on the plane who had the window seat in her role refused to fully dim their window, even after a flight attendant asked. A man in the middle section of the plane held an airline pillow up to the side of his face for nearly an hour to block out the sun, Ming said in an email. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed listening and that you'll join us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And I remind you, the content of our program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Now, Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.